I saw and understood that anti-Zionism just is anti-Semitism. And once you see that, you can't unsee it.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guest today is a philosophy professor at Connecticut College, twice tenured. He is the author of multiple books about anti-Semitism, philosophy, and two fiction books.
Four
fiction books. And here I am with Andrew Pessin.
Shai, thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege. You've really become one of my heroes over the last couple of years. So it's an honor to be sharing the space with you.
I am so, so glad that you're here. I think you probably are the first professor that I have had as a guest.
Good for you. Good for you. You know, my tagline is, I do a weekly podcast, which we might talk about, but as I introduce myself, I say, I'm a professor, please don't hate me. So, professors are, unfortunately, to a large degree, the enemy these days. Good for you for, holding off this long.
We'll talk about that because it is a painful thing.
It's a painful thing.
Conversations with my fellow professors.
Yeah.
But Andrew, before we begin, I have to ask the question that I ask every guest. Andrew Pessin, what kind of a Jew are you?
I guess the first thing that comes to mind might be something like a non-observant Orthodox Jew or the non-Jewish Jew, to use a phrase from Isaac Deutscher. But I actually, as I think about that question, I remember a Chabad rabbi I spoke to back in Columbus, Ohio, 25 years ago or something. And he was talking about a survey that was being done in Columbus, and they wanted to know, which denomination are you, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, Reconstruction? Are you a Democratic, et cetera? And he said, my answer to all of them was, I'm a Jew. I'm not going to make those distinctions. So I think in the end, on the bottom, I would say, I'm a Jew.
You're a Jew.
I'm a Jew.
And I want to jump right into a specific moment that you had, which another professor, Professor Gil Troy, calls a
Herzl moment. Yeah.
Okay. So I want to jump right into that, but can you describe what a Herzl moment is?
Yes. So as Professor Troy puts it, the Herzl's moment was, of course, famously, at least according to the story, the Dreyfus trial and the watching the ceremony where Dreyfus's medals were ripped from him and his sword broken, and hearing the crowds yelling death to the Jews there. And that was the moment he understood, according to the story, that Jews had no future in France or in Europe in general, and that launched the modern political Zionist movement. So the Herzl moment is the moment you see there's a problem, and it's a big problem. And as we update that to the 21st century, for me, the Herzl moment is the moment, the way I put it in my personal experience, the moment that I saw and understood, in a phrase, that anti-Zionism just is anti-Semitism. And once you see that, you can't unsee it. And so that's what a Herzl moment is. And I gather we're coming to mine.
We're coming to yours. But before we get to yours, I want to get to the moment before your Herzl moment. Who were you before you had that clear notion of, hey, this is the same thing, anti-Zionism?
I was, as apparently my very short Wikipedia entry has it, an American philosopher. My mom is very proud of that. He's an American philosopher. I studied Descartes, René Descartes, I think, Therefore I Am. He's like the one historical figure that many people have heard of because of I Think, Therefore I Am. I studied Descartes and his philosophy and his followers and his critics, Cartesianism, mostly writing papers, as I like to say. I'd spend a couple hundred hours writing a detailed academic article about Descartes, Cartesianism. Very proud of that work, but then, as I would say, 10 people would read it, 9 of whom ignored it, and 1 of whom criticized it mercilessly. And that was the life of sort of an average American philosopher. And it was okay for me. I was happy doing that. And I can actually defend the value of that, even though I sort of make fun of it here a little bit. It was valuable for me, and I felt like I was making my contribution, at least to my field, in an adequate way. So that's who I was before my Herzl moment.
And just like Herzl was a journalist, a playwright, did a lot of different things that had nothing to do with him being Jewish and with the burgeoning Zionist movement, but then he had his moment and everything changed. You had your moment in 2015.
I did. So, you know, what I'll say, and this is the moment, as I said, that I came to see that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. By the way, as a professor and a philosopher, I could nuance that expression a dozen different ways. I've actually written a 100-page article on the relationship between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. But in the end, it boils down to anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And what basically happened was, I'll give you the short version, and if you want to probe, you can ask further questions. But I had written a series of Facebook posts, live blogging, as they say, the 2014 Hamas-Israel war, which seemed awful at the time, but of course, you know, nothing in retrospect, given what we've seen in the years since. And one of the posts I wrote was taken out of context by various people, and it was a post defending Israel's right to defend itself by means of a blockade on Gaza. And it was taken completely out of its context, which changes its meaning entirely, and it was portrayed quite widely around the world as a racist post about Palestinians, even though it was about Hamas and it was actually defending something very specific, the right to have this blockade. And just seeing the way so many people in the world were primed and just ready to condemn the Jew, right, for standing up for the Jews' right to defend themselves and portraying that Jewish right to defend themselves as a racist endeavor. That was the moment I saw, this is not an honest discourse. People were not interested in actually understanding what the post was saying, that people didn't speak to me. They just, it was, as Tuvia Tenenbaum's wonderful book, like Catch the Jew, you should read it, everyone should read it. But that was it. They were looking for something they could catch the Jew on. And when they could frame it from a position of virtue, we are anti-racist, this Jew is the racist, they went all in, even though it was all based on a fabrication, a lie, a misrepresentation, etc. So the readiness with which people literally around the world, it became an international death threat generating campaign. It was a very scary period for us and my family. Our Jewish day school had to put on extra security because we weren't taking any chances. But the ease with which people will just drop their normal cognitive processes or their epistemic processes, their knowledge-forming processes, if they can get the Jew, is what showed me that they weren't interested in any sort of discourse. They're interested in destroying the Jew. And so it's framed as anti-Zionism because we're defending, in this case, the Palestinians, and you're allegedly calling being racist towards them, but it was catch the Jew.
So a lot of people listening, watching, are wondering, what was this post? What was the trigger to catch the Jew?
So at the time in 2014, amongst the many things being discussed during that particular war was, first of all, the civilian militant casualty count, right? Because Israel is always blamed for killing all the civilians and not targeting the militants. And of course, the blockade. And so all sorts of human rights organizations and certainly the anti-Israel folks were all arguing that, well, of course, Hamas is fighting and they're justified because you've essentially got them in a cage, right? The blockade, you know, the open air prison, as they call it, or the concentration camp, all of which, of course, are just total lies. But in any case, that was what was going on in the world, the claim that their violence was justified because Israel's got them in a cage. And I was making the point, and fatefully, as I said, the post begins by saying, if I could draw, this would be a cartoon. And had it been a cartoon, there wouldn't have been any ambiguity, but I can't draw. So it was quite fateful. And by the way, since then, someone else drew the cartoon, and I have a copy of that. But in any case, I made an analogy between, imagine someone had a rabid dog in a cage, and you had all these human rights organizations, and the dog is barking violently, trying to get out of the cage. And you had all these human rights organizations saying, of course he's barking angrily. You've got him in a cage. Let him out. And what they're doing is, of course, reversing cause and effect there. He's not angry because he's not potentially violent because he's in the cage. He's in the cage because he was potentially violent. And so I use this analogy to defend Israel blockading Hamas, which is the blockade is in place because Hamas poses a threat of non-negotiable violence against Israel. And by the way, when October 7th happened, I wanted to say, see, right? And I did get one or two people who wrote to me and said, I think you were right back then. But the point was, the post was said just in terms of this analogy, a man with a rabid dog in a cage, and it was decided by all sorts of parties that Pessin thinks Palestinians are dogs who should be put in cages. That's how it got represented. And you know, I could actually prove it was about Hamas.
You were talking about Hamas and
it well, was the Post itself doesn't use that word. So if it had been a cartoon, the dog would have had a little vest that said Hamas on it, right? Mm-hmm. But because I just described the dog, it allowed someone, if you took that post out of context of all the surrounding posts, you could say it's about the Palestinians. And even so, by the way, it's not equivalent to saying Palestinians are dogs that should be caged. Nevertheless, I could actually prove, and a scholar, wonderful scholar, Richard Landis, you should maybe consider having him on if this professor passes your test and you'll have another. Richard Landis is a really important figure. He ended up writing a whole book about this affair called Salem on the Thames, because it illustrated all sorts of really interesting, deep things. But if one looked at that post in the context of all my posts that preceded it and all the ones that followed it, it would be unambiguously clear I was talking about Hamas. Right. But nobody bothered, because you could take this little text out of context and give it a meaning that it doesn't have and get the Jew.
But something interesting, you know, there's so many troubling and interesting and fascinating aspects of this moment that you had. One that really caught me off guard is, while you were doing this live blogging during the Israel-Hamas war, which was until the October 7 war, was the longest war in between Israel and Hamas. It was 53 days, July and August 2014. The story didn't start until 6 months later.
Yeah, right. It started at least 6 months later, which is, you know, the post, I guess, wasn't discovered by the people who were interested in running the campaign. So once they discovered it, you know, it became pretty clear to me. You know, there were all sorts of parties, I believe, in retrospect, watching me from off campus, basically, like waiting to get the Jew. Because, and I wasn't particularly known as a Zionist. I was the philosopher then, but I did some, you know, advocating on Facebook primarily at the time. I think Facebook was still cool in 2014
but
or 15.
You said discovered as if it's a passive, you know, a post.
Yeah, no.
Discovered.
So I came
Somebody
to believe
to
that people went looking, you know, and which, you know, like I said, I do believe people off campus were beginning to track me. And what makes that all the more bitter, and this is really why it was clear it wasn't a good faith campaign, was because if you're looking through my posts, you would have seen, and in fact, there were 17 posts prior to it and 9 posts immediately after. So this was in the middle of 27 posts, right, altogether. And what am I doing in all those other posts? First of all, I am regularly distinguishing Hamas from the civilian population, because the main issue was what's the proportion of casualties, and making it 100% clear that Hamas is the primary source of violence coming out of Gaza. So with that information, then you look at the one post, which is literally the one post that doesn't mention the word Hamas, right, out of 27. Yeah. When you put that in the middle there, then clearly I'm talking about, it's like literally indisputable. But what, as I came to understand that there was a campaign in place, like that they were going through my post to see if they could find something, that means they saw that whole thing and they knew perfectly well that what I was talking about, but take this post out of context and you can give it a different meaning. So it wasn't an honest misunderstanding. It was a deliberate campaign. I came to believe that.
And what happened next?
You know, so it generated, it went viral. So as I mentioned, generated international death threats. Petitions went around the world calling for me to be fired that were filled with very, very scary comments about, like, you know, we got to remove all the Zionists. That sound familiar, like Zionists off campus, which is, you know, a major chant of the last few years. It didn't begin the last few years. It was starting. And indeed, I should mention, in 2018, I ended up publishing a book called Anti-Zionism on Campus, documenting the professors and students who had been targeted on campus for this. So it was well underway prior to October 7th. It's only, you know, fuel has been added to that fire. It became this international campaign.
How do you get to a point of an international campaign? Like, it's something posted by a professor of philosophy at Connecticut College.
Right.
All of a sudden, an international campaign. What are the links there?
I don't know that I can fill in all those details, except that, you know, with the internet, which amongst the many wonderful things about the internet, everything good and bad can spread instantly. So it just took, you know, took one person to, I think, started with a change.org petition against me, which they then worked to circulate around the world, you know, and once it circulates around the world, then it spreads and spreads and spreads. And there was such glee in catching the Zionist being a racist, even though, as I said, it was based on a distorted misrepresentation of the post itself. And for a long time, because I am naive, I think was the critical way of putting it, but I am a person of good will and intention, and my default value is to believe the best of other people until they prove themselves conclusively. So for a very long time, I thought, it's just a misunderstanding. They misunderstood the post, and all I have to do is explain that it's not saying what you think it's saying. And it took my rabbi, who, when I finally brought him on board, because he was also a lawyer, so, you know, several weeks into it, I finally started to think, maybe I should talk to a lawyer. Well, my rabbi was a lawyer, wonderful lawyer. And I mentioned to him, and in 30 seconds, he said, this is totally an anti-Semitic destruction campaign. And I was like, nah, it's just a misunderstanding. And it took me far longer than it should have to understand it was not a matter of good faith. So, I think you had people that were just primed to publicize the Zionist racist, to portray the Zionist as a racist.
But I think there's a few other really important details that I want to focus on, not because, you know, they are sensational or anything, but because to show people what actually happened. Mm-hmm. So without mentioning names, you got an email from a student in one of your classes about this post. And my understanding is that this is 6 months after, and you immediately deleted the post or removed part of it.
Yeah, no, I responded by saying, oh, I'm sorry, you've really misunderstood this post, but I apologize if the post lent itself to misunderstanding, and I've deleted it, instantly deleted it.
Which is, you know, if we take a step back from your story, should be the response, you know, first of all, I'm sorry if this is misinterpreted. Let me explain what my intention was, but also I will remove it so there's no...
I don't want to be misunderstood, I don't want to be misunderstood, and I even apologized if the post lent itself to misunderstanding, because, you know, when you're writing, when I mentioned the 17 before and the 9 after, numbers that got burned into my brain during the affair, you know, I was probably doing 7 or 8 a day, right? Like live blogging, the war was going on, I was online a lot, too much, right? And when I'm writing that post, I've just finished writing the previous post where I've distinguished between Hamas and the civilians. So in my mind, I know exactly what I mean, right? But sometimes what happens is someone who just sees this post, it could maybe support their reading, right? You know, and I don't want to be ambiguous, just my own sake, but just as a philosopher, I tell my students all the time, like your goal should be to make sure you're not misunderstood, you know? And of course, we'll all fail on that because you can't always control how people will read or interpret your words. And again, it would be unfair to put a reading on my words that I disavow and that require ignoring the context. But nevertheless, I'm sorry that I wrote something that could have raise those thoughts in anybody else's mind. And of course I deleted it.
And I think that was a noble thing to do.
Thank you.
And the story could have ended there.
Should have ended, right?
But then a few days later or weeks later, the student goes and writes an op-ed, a letter in the student newspaper about your post and, you know, not really mentioning the whole part of like, he explained, he apologized, and he deleted and goes on a witch hunt.
So let me not comment specifically on that other than to say it's interesting, and especially it got enormous insofar as it became an off-campus affair, like this, as I said, international death threat generating. And the ease with which people will condemn before speaking to the person or getting their side of the story was, you know, part of the thing which, again, opened my eyes that this is not honest. Because I know that if, in fact, I just recently lost a 45-year friendship over someone who did something similar, which maybe I can talk about a little bit later if you like. But the ease with which someone will condemn you without speaking to you, without getting your side of the story, is a sign of bad faith, right? It's a sign of someone who's not interested in truth, doesn't have integrity, et cetera. And that's the thing that really struck me, that crucial things, including my disavowing of that interpretation. I said, no, you've misunderstood. Like, that's crucial you know, you're welcome to decide that what I say is my interpretation is not the correct interpretation, but that's a weird thing that you never do anywhere else. Like when the author tells you what something means, who are you to say it means something other, right? It's you wouldn't use that normally, but when it comes to catching a Jew, people will do that, right? So they drop their normal standards.
And but I think there's something, again, so sinister about this entire affair, which is why I'm spending a lot of time on it, to, again, not because it's so rare, but because it's so common and it's happening to professors all over the country and the world, and they might see the same story in them. And I want to quote from the, again, without saying the name of the student's letter said that she had never felt uncomfortable in class, but just because...
She had had me as a professor the year before,
She said that just because Pessin's views don't interfere with his teaching doesn't mean they are not a problem, meaning that it's not what you do, it's not what you support, it's if a student or a colleague doesn't agree with your views,
your problem.
That is a problem.
Yeah.
And that is ground for, at minimum, cancellation or an international deaf generation.
You know, considering if you move away from the imagery of the post and go to the message of the post, it's that it was defending the right that Jews have to defend themselves from non-negotiable genocidal violence, right? That's a problem, right?
That's
in the end,
problem.
That's a problem, right? And that's, you know, where is anti-Zionism more clearly anti-Semitism than when the idea that Jews have the right to defend themselves from genocide is racist? I mean, right, so...
So you had that Herzl moment.
That was my, you know.
And
it took me, as I said, a few weeks or months because just a misunderstanding. Like, everyone's good faith here. And I, you know, eventually learned other things which made me realize it was an orchestrated campaign. And you know, mentioned while this was happening to me, I got a call from a very wonderful person you might also consider having guest, Tammy Rossman Benjamin, who runs Amcha Initiative, a fantastic organization that focuses on the campus. And this is when I met her. She called me and she said, what's happening to you is exactly what's happened to me. And she started explaining her own experience at UC Santa Cruz. And again, it was taking something she had said in a lecture completely out of context, giving it a different meaning, and then going after her. There was a campus campaign against her at her institution. And that's when we realized, oh, this isn't just, it's not just a one-off, it's a pattern, it's a structure. And that's when I ended up, you know, my next project was this book I mentioned, Anti-Zionism on Campus. I put out some feelers. I said, I wonder how many other people this is happening to. And I, you know, went on a few listservs and said, do you know of any other cases where Zionist professors are, I think we were already using the canceled language then, but like campaigns against them. And I was flooded, right? We were flooded. And I worked with Daron Ben-Attar, who's a history professor at Fordham, who had had a similar thing happen to him. And so we put this volume together in 2018. And I don't remember exactly how many chapters, but I think there were about 18 chapters, basically faculty members telling their experience. And we had like six students telling what it's like to be a Zionist Jew on their campuses. So this was an orchestrated campaign, you know, 2015 to 2018. It was in full gear that an academic press published this anthology documenting this.
And what was the reaction to your book? And of course, you know, academic, we know that people rarely read, but of the people that did read, were they convinced, yes, there's a problem, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, or did they just brush it off as, what happened?
It's hard to generalize. Certainly, you know, the Zionist professors in academia were aware this was going on and felt alarmed. I don't know that I want to criticize the mainstream Jewish organizations. You know, what I like to say is I don't want to call what the mainstream organizations have been doing a failure, but it's a failure, right? I mean,
but it's not a success.
And who knows how worse it would have been if they hadn't done whatever they did do. Like, you know, what I've seen, and so from 2015 onwards, after my Herzl moment, right, I've been watching the campus scene very closely. I ended up working for the Allgemeiner for 9 years, which is a wonderful news outlet that focuses on Jews in Israel. Everyone should subscribe to it. Just recently left after 9 years. And I was appointed their inaugural campus bureau editor because the Allgemeiner realized, like, the campus scene is very problematic. This was 2015, and they reached out to me because they'd heard about what had happened to me. And so for the last 9 years, as for the Allgemeiner, my eye has been on the campuses watching this problem get worse and worse and worse. I've seen the clear trajectory, just, you know, upwards or downwards, depending which metaphor you want to use, but getting worse and worse, going downwards, downwards. The problem with downwards is you think it bottoms out, but upwards can go on indefinitely. Yeah. So the problem increased in quality and quantity over these 9 years. And so part of me feels like whatever we've done is a failure because the problem's just worse and worse and worse. But again, you don't know how much worse. The slope would have been steeper, right? So, you know, having said that, the book certainly got traction amongst academics. We wrote some articles in the more popular press. I know we did something in Tablet back then. You know, I got the sense that the organized Jewish community, you know, this is maybe a typical thing, right? First of all, keep your head down, don't cause trouble, right? Like, and I understand that in the end it comes a point when it's not acceptable to do that, but I understand the instinct. It was easy for a lot of people to say, oh, college kids, you know, they're up to their shenanigans or whatever, and dismiss it. And I know I was, in the pieces I was writing, I was saying, I don't think this should be dismissed. And I understand, all right, you know, one professor gets a problem, you can deal with it. But when it's an orchestrated campaign, and more importantly, the deeper thing is, of course, it's not just that they're attacking individuals. This is the process which leads to removing Jews from campus. Anti-Zionism is always the tool that is used to remove Jews from campus. And we could also see that Zionism as an ideology was becoming toxic. And that's part of the general decay of the university.
The perception of Zionism as an ideology, not the ideology.
This is what they're selling, and right. And so to me, it wasn't just about, all right, 3 professors, 18 professors, right? Like 18 is already a serious number. Any individual instance maybe isn't so horrible, but when you realize it's really an orchestrated campaign, and it is, it's organized and clearly funded, unclear ultimately by who, but it's clearly funded and organized, you realize this is something we should be paying attention to. And I know that I felt frustrated that not enough of the legacy organizations were really seeing how serious it was. And just, you know, not to compare myself to Herzl, but, you know, it took Herzl a long time to begin convincing people, this is serious, right? And you can always imagine, just as we talk about, like, looking back at 1930s German Jews, like, why didn't you get out? And, you know, you read the actual stories and you understand, like, oh, you don't believe it's as bad as you think it is, or you think it'll pass, or, you know, I'm a good German citizen, I was in the army, whatever. Like, while it's happening, you can excuse it away, and it's only in retrospect it looks so clear they should have gotten out. And as I, you know, have taken to saying, I'm wondering, future historians, when they look back at American Jews in the, you know, the 2020s, like, why didn't they get out, right? Like, why didn't they get out? And I understand, because I see people making all sorts of excuses now, like, it's not so bad, it'll pass.
You know,
college campuses, which it's not.
When I, and we'll get to that, but when I, at first, when everything started, and I was also naive in a way for me, and when I would talk about Columbia, I would say, look, what is happening now is going into the history books.
Right.
And all I'm doing is fighting to make it a footnote rather than the chapter or the turning point.
Nice, right.
But you're right. Like you
now it's a 10-volume edition. So.
Right. And you can't know while you're living it
which way it's going to go. Right. But, you know, I have the advantage or disadvantage of being, you know, so keyed on this issue since 2015. You know, one of the few people, especially from the perch of the Allgemeine, where literally every day I'm online scouring for the stories, right? And I have these now hundreds of pages of lists of incidents. And for those who are interested, and I don't recommend it, it's only for hardy people with strong will, but I do publish a list every day of, you know, incidents, campus incidents. I've been doing that for a number of years now. And I do a weekly podcast where I give the highlights and lowlights of the incidents of the week. So if you're interested, find out. But from that perch, you know, I literally I can see the trajectory, you know. And when you see the pattern, not just isolated incidents, which most people, all right, I read a story, a professor had trouble, and then a year later you read another story. But when you're watching it daily, you know, it's not a perfect straight line. There's some zigs and zags. But as I said, you know, you just see the problem getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And as I, you know, and so once it's a pattern, like, there's no excuse for me staying because I see what the next step is, right? And, you know, what I say about October 7th and October 8th, when I saw the campus response to this massacre, not horror and condemnation, but generally on all major campuses, celebration and endorsement, right, of this thing, I was not the slightest bit surprised because it was literally the next logical step in the trajectory that I had been marking all of these years. It was still shocking to see it really happen. But it was not a bit surprising. It was literally the next step. And as long as that keeps going, well, what's the next step after that? How is it not pogroms? I mean, it's like physical violence against Jews, which we have seen a number of important instances of already. And then the next step is large-scale versions of that. Now, admittedly, and I don't know if you want to go here, but, you know, the election of Trump might affect that trajectory one way. I do believe had Harris been elected, that trajectory, nothing would have checked it. It's too early to say what the impact of the Trump is on that. But in terms of that straight line, that's the first thing that sort of happened that maybe could check the, you know, the momentum of that trajectory for better or for worse.
And so let's talk about that pattern, that trajectory.
Okay.
What is that pattern? What should people be looking for? You know, you've been watching it for 10 years.
Right.
You're collecting data points.
Right.
What are these data points and what's going on?
So I just, in this past spring, I published a two-volume work called Israel Breathes, World Condemns. And you mentioned you had a copy, so thank you. Oh, thank you. Show
here,
it.
Right,
yeah,
here.
That's volume one or two. I don't know.
That's volume one, The Trajectory,
the trajectory.
October 7th. From the campus front.
Yeah, the trajectory, right? So, and then volume two is from October 7th onwards, seeing the aftermath of that event on campus. And so, you know, what you see, so I've been writing on this issue for many years, and so, and these books basically collect a lot of my writings over the last 10 years. And when you sort of, when I looked at them in order, I saw, this is when I really could see the trajectory. So a number of them are documenting just particular episodes or incidents that happened on campuses. And what you'll notice is the frequency increases dramatically. It used to be a BDS vote here in a student government, another one at some other student government. And BDS votes were very easy to dismiss for a lot of years. They really began as long ago as about 20 years ago on campuses. But like, you know, what a student government says or thinks has no impact. No university had officially, you know, responded to the BDS resolution. So it was easy to dismiss. But easier to dismiss when it's one here and a year later, another one there. It's a little less easy to dismiss when it's campus after campus after campus. And they used to fail more than they succeeded, but then it started to be succeeding more than they failed, right? And then you see the incidents attacking professors and ostracizing students. Those begin. You also see the position of the Israel-hating groups on campus. So Students for Justice Palestine is the main one. There's lots of variations, but let's just call them all SJPs, even though not all brand that way. SJP used to be on a few campuses. Then it was on a lot of campuses. Then it's on most major campuses. And you also would see their activities and their doctrines getting more extreme. So really, when I was first watching this in 2015, it was about the two-state solution. They were demanding a Palestinian state. But already by 2020, 2021, I don't think you'll find a single SJP demanding a two-state solution. They're demanding openly the destruction of Israel. And the cynics about the two-state solution on the pro-Israel side didn't really believe them when they said they wanted a Palestinian state, because many on our side believe the Palestinian state is just the next step towards the destruction of Israel. But at least their branding, right? At least what they said out loud was, this is Palestinian rights, Palestinian self-determination. We want a Palestinian state. So that's at least acceptable to say, in my view, right?
Which is, by the way, it's very difficult to argue for Zionism, which is self-determination of a people, and you know,
exactly.
The Jewish people, and then say, you know, and argue against the self-determination of a different people.
Right, but that shifted. Yeah. So even in the five, six, by 2020, 2021, that's not the position any of them will argue now. It's openly, we don't want two states, we want 1948 is one of their big slogans, right? And they're not even hiding what they want is the destruction of the state of Israel. And, you know, they also began their anti-normalization, they call it. So you had these groups on campus that won't even speak to the Zionist students, which basically largely means the Jewish students, right? Not all
and
Jews are Zionists.
And would not allow Zionists to speak on campus.
And
right?
And would not allow Zionists to speak on campus. Or a Zionist, and this is when this started happening too, by the late 2010s, 2019, 2020, you know, it's one thing, I get it, why an SJP isn't going to invite a Zionist speaker, even though in the ideal world of a university, why shouldn't they, right? Like, invite someone with an opposing view, engage, you know, like, I've often seen you on campus, so let's have a conversation, you know.
That's a very, like, a philosophy professor.
No, that is, right? Not a philosopher. That's a person who believes that the university has certain norms that should be respected,
right?
Why shouldn't an SJP invite a Zionist, and why shouldn't a Hillel invite an anti-Zionist in the ideal world, right? But I understand why SJP will say we're not going to platform a Zionist. However, you know, there was a case, was this at, I want to say this was at Binghamton. I could be wrong. They all blend together after a while. But, you know, there was a student, a woman, she had founded an a cappella group. And then by her senior year, the a cappella group kicked her out because she was a Zionist, right? Like, if the group has literally nothing to do with Jews, Israel politics, it's outrageous to use Zionism as a litmus test, right? And so we started seeing that by, it was part of the anti-normalization. It's one thing if the SJP won't speak to the Zionist group, but it becomes another thing. We have to anti-normalize Zionists. We cannot have relationships with Zionists. Well, now you are discriminating against Jews on your campus. And this isn't speech anymore. This is action. And that just took off like wildfire. So there were so many examples of students being kicked out of clubs, not welcomed into fraternities or things like that because they were Zionists. So you watch the episodes increase in frequency, they increase in intensity, and the rhetoric of the other side is increasing in violence, right? The anti-normalization, destruction of Israel. And by 2021, you know, again, that war, there was another war, right? They all blur together after a while. But the 2021 war was it 10 days? I don't know.
It was very short.
It was a short one, right? Yeah. You know, to me, this was the next major step in the trajectory because this was the one where petition signed by academics, and this is, you know, again, professor, please don't hate me. Dozens of petitions signed by tens of thousands of academics around the world, not just condemning Israel. Like, again, if you want to have a conversation, you know, you want to support Palestinian rights, you're critical of a lot of Israeli decisions, okay, we can have that conversation. I won't agree with you, but it belongs at the table. These petitions that went around were not that. Most important, first of all, they would tell these unbelievably one-sided stories of the war. Like, this is Israel's assault on Hamas, leaving out that Hamas started the war, Hamas's rockets. I can't remember even what was the immediate trigger of the 2021 war. It was the 2014 was the kidnapping of the three, right? Yes. So I remember. But, you know, it is a two-way war. And this is also part of the rhetoric now. This is when they call it a genocide today. What they're trying to say is it's not a two-way war. It's a one-sided assault. Right. So they leave Hamas out of the story altogether. But most importantly, the trope of Jewish supremacy was appearing in a lot of these petitions. So and this grows out of, you know, the NGO campaign to label Israel as an apartheid state. But by 2021, I cannot tell you how many of these academics petitions signed by tens of thousands of people said that, you know, Israel is the usual genocidal ethnic cleansing baby killing in the pursuit of Jewish supremacy. We're now talking, this is Nazi language, this is Goebbels language, right? Jewish supremacy, ultimately protocols of the Elders of Zion, going back to there. And it is stunning that that's what people are signing their names to. And this is, so 2021, I wrote a song about, I'm a musician also, I wrote a song about anti-Semitism. And if there's any talented musicians out there who want to record it, free, you take it. I would like it to, I think it's a great song. And to me, that's when I started seeing in America, and this was also at that war, there were a number of physical assaults of Jews, like in public, over that little 10-day war, right? So for me, that was the moment, you know, long this is like my Herzl squared moment, right? Like, not only is this a problem, but I think I'm afraid. Like, I'm afraid for Jews physically. I don't feel physically safe in America in 2021. This is the 2020 war. Again, getting me to the point where I would write a song about anti-Semitism, thinking, and, you know, and I said, like, you know, what's the next step is going to be really the entire public square turning against Jews, and then 2023 happens, you know, October 7th happens. So that's what I mean. They get more frequent, they get more intense, the rhetoric gets more violence. And on October 7th, even by October 8th, we see campuses saying, you know, hail the freedom fighters, you know, celebrate this beautiful thing. They are openly cheering mass murder of Jews now, right?
You said that you weren't surprised by the reaction for the October 7th massacre, but did anything in the magnitude surprise you, in the encampments, in the political world around it? Did anything surprise you or?
Surprise? No. Again, shocking to see it actually happen, but, you know, intellectually, not a surprise. Even the, you know, the encampments, which took until the spring, right? And of course, Columbia, Ground Zero, you know.
They were waiting for the weather to get nice because
because who wants to, right, encamp in the winter?
Fight for their ideals when it's cold out.
That's right. No, exactly. But, you know, in terms of the magnitude, you know, I know, again, I was still with the Allgemeiner, so I'm just, you know, on a typical day, I don't know, I generate during the school year, I had 12 or 14 possible incidents or stories to, you know, the Allgemeiner might report on, et cetera.
On a typical day, not week.
Oh, typical day. Typical day, 12, 10 to, you know, as I used to say with the, so I was started doing this to find stories for the Allgemeiner to cover. And on a typical day during the school year, it would be 10 to 12 to 14 possible stories. Not all great stories, but, you know, I'm finding everything that's relevant to this issue. And, you know, the Allgemeiner had the capacity to report on one or two per day. And then I would point out that, you know, the stories I find mostly by scouring the internet, but I also people send me things now, right, because I'm the guy who collects them. I know I'm only catching the tip of the iceberg. I can't, like, I'm not online 12 hours a day. I'm only online a certain amount. So I'm only even seeing the 10 or 12 or 14 is like the tip of the iceberg of what's out there. And then the Allgemeiner was only covering one or two per day typically, right? Like, and so I was aware of the magnitude that this is going on in a lot of places, like all over the place. But most people can't be aware of that because you're only seeing one or two stories a day, right? But again, to see it in those days after October 7th, when in those months I was reporting 40 stories a day, right? 50, because it was so many campuses and so many stories per campus. As you know, Columbia was the gift that kept on giving, you know, for people in the news business. Thank you, Columbia. Like, you know, the Jewish news organizations, I think, you know, profited very nicely from the horrific news coverage.
I'm sure they would have given away that profit.
I would have happily not had a single story from Columbia, but, you know, when one is being a little bit morbid, as I tend to be, right? It's like, you know, thank you, kept us employed, frankly.
But I want to focus on that. You know, right. 12 to 14 incidents a day might sound okay. You know, I don't know if that's important or not, right. But that translates to 4,000, about 4,000 instances.
Did you just do the math in your head? That well, that,
yeah, I'm, yeah.
Well, 10, 3, 3,600, 4,000. Yeah, not that hard. Good.
And as a professor, I always like when.
But you're a business professor. You should give me the exact number.
But. If this was any other ism,
yeah, right? Exactly,
racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, xenophobia, things that are horrible and should be equally expunged from society, everyone would be talking about that.
Everyone would be talking about it, right?
And yet there's not many Andrew Pessins out there.
Well, Jews don't count, to quote David Baddiel's, but right, like Jews don't. This has been clear. You know, certainly since the rise of, let's call it the progressive movement or its capture of our campuses or domination on, you know, at least the major campuses, it's sad to say and painful to say as a Jewish person whose natural home was on the left side of the spectrum politically for a long time, you know, as I like to say, maybe, you know, I think you're also that, right? I believe, like, you know, I stayed put and then the left, you know, zoomed over to the left and now I'm like a right-wing fanatic without having ever changed my views, fundamental views. But, you know, the capture of progressivism is very hostile to the Jews, unfortunately, and that's been a crucial part. Jews don't count because we're oppressors.
But so what about other professors? You know, you're slightly older than I am. You know, you've been in this profession, in this industry for many, many years. What's the mindset of professors? And let's put the Jewish and Israeli professors aside because they might feel like they're the ones under attack and they don't want to speak up and anger the mobs even more. But our colleagues, if it's hard to not see 4,000 instances a year.
Yeah. So, you
know.
You
need to really not look to not see.
Well, you know, we also have the media. The mainstream media isn't interested, right? The mainstream media is overwhelmingly not supportive of the Jewish condition, I think. So I'm not blaming a lot of just average professors whose interests might not be the Middle East or Israel, right? They have no skin in that game or something like that. There's no reason for them to know about this. Like, and, you know, and so I can't blame any individuals, but, you know, what we also have, I do, but here's the following. Let me put a little context. So at least until the recent sort of collapses and mergers. Higher education is in a major crisis now for a lot of reasons, including this one. But there used to be something like 4,000 accredited institutions of higher education, I think, in North America. That's a lot. And the problems that we're talking about are occurring on, you know, 100 to 150 of them. the overwhelming majority of campuses where most people, average people go, these issues are very, very quiet, right? They're not mostly not happening, or if they're happening, it's on the smallest scale. It's not a crisis. But of course, the bad news gets the clicks, and it should. I mean, we should know about the bad news, right? You don't want to hear a story that says nothing happened on this campus today. That's not a story.
All is quiet, right?
Like, you know, so you get the impression that it's everywhere, and it isn't everywhere. So that's one thing. Having said that, you know, AMCHA Initiative has done studies on this. So where is it? It's on the campuses where there are Jews, right? Which tells you something very important. The most virulent, both in quantity and quality, anti-Israel activity tends to be on campuses with more Jewish students and professors, and which tells you, who are they targeting? They're not targeting Israel, or they might be targeting Israel, but they're targeting the local Jews, right? These movements, because campuses with no Jews, there's like little motivation to put on an anti-Israel rally. In fact, you feel a little bit like probably like a racist if there's no Jews around, then you're just like hating on Jews through hating Israel. So I think what that reveals is that these movements are not, they say they're about resisting Israel or criticizing Israel, they're really about making their local Jews uncomfortable, which they succeed in doing. So on the 100 campuses, I don't want to dismiss that. I want to say it's on the campuses where Jews are because it's targeting those Jews.
But let me play devil's advocate here and say, you know, from the other side, they would say, we are just reacting to the fact that where there are Jews, there are pro-Israel voices, and we're reacting to the pro-Israel voices. Right. So in fact, it has nothing to do with anti-Semitism.
Right. Except that, you know, I think most Jews are, you know, even the Zionists, and according to whatever surveys, right, like roughly speaking, half the world's Jews live in Israel. And of the remaining half, the significant majority are supportive of Israel. They have family in Israel. They visit Israel, right? So like we know that the anti-Zionist Jews are relatively small, perhaps growing. Seems likely that they're growing, but still relatively small. Percentage of the Jewish community. They're loud and they're vocal and they're visible for obvious reasons, including that they provide convenient cover for the Jew hatred of the anti-Israel movement. But, you know, even these Zionist Jews, and I think I was a Zionist Jew in college. I was not an activist in any way whatsoever. I was more interested in my studies and my social life in college, like I think students
should be.
Yeah, right, exactly. But, you know, I think I was pro-Israel back then, but I felt no need to, like, argue for Israel or involve. I don't even have any recollection of pro-Israel activity on my campus. And maybe there was. So my point was that argument is disingenuous because they're largely not responding to what the Jewish, quote-unquote, Zionists are doing because they tend to be quiet. Most of them, this is part of the problem of Jewish advocacy, we're always playing defense, where we are the ones responding, right? The other side is the aggressor. They come out with all of their slanders and libels and criticisms and events and apartheid weeks, etc. And when the Jewish community on a campus, in many, too many campuses, finally gets its act together, it's just we got to refute the lies, we're, you know, etc. And you're already behind, as we know. That's a very bad strategy. And there are some groups. I'm a big fan of students supporting Israel. I think they're a good grassroots group. They're growing. They are pretty unabashed and unapologetic, and they go on the offense in the good way, I think, as far as I can see. So shout out to them. But I think it's not true to say they're targeting the Zionist voices because the Zionist voices tend to be quiet. And this was my own attitude before when I was just a philosopher, an American philosopher. I did a little bit of advocacy on Facebook. I wasn't going to bring pro-Israel speakers into campus. My campus was quiet. Why would I disturb that quiet, right? So I'm guilty of that myself. I think in retrospect, maybe that wasn't the right strategy. But I think most Jews on most campuses like it quiet. And it's responding to the aggression. So I don't think it's honest to say you're responding to the Zionist voices.
Okay. Well, that's good. So I do.
Which isn't to say there might be some individuals for whom that's true. Right. I mean, right. But just as we're looking at general trends.
Of course. And I think if I'm reading you correctly, is you're not saying that each and every protester holds these beliefs
of course not.
In their minds, but the leaders, the organizations that basically take away the agency from these specific protesters and just say, chant this, hold this sign, you know, wave this flag, wear this keffiyeh, they are the ones that are guilty.
I'm willing to go even further in a charitable way than what you just did, which was very lovely, right? Which is to say, and you know, and this is to use a lesson from the progressive movement, which is you know, racism doesn't require intent. There can be racist behavior, or to use Larry Summers' famous thing, anti-Semitism, if not in intent, then in effect. It may well be that most or all of the campus activists, I don't actually believe this, but most or all of them really are sincerely committed to human rights and believe that this is like a path of justice, etc. But the movement itself can still be anti-Semitic, certainly in effect, right? Mm. So, you know, one wants to hesitate to judge what's going on inside any individual's mind. You can't know in most cases. Some of them tell you openly, so, you know, those you can judge. But for most of the kids, and, you know, presumably you did reference what is sort of commonly understood, a lot of these movements on campuses, there's, you know, the hardcore in the center, and then there's the more peripheral people, and then there's just, you know, the socialites who think this is a cool party, right, et cetera. And they have different degrees of culpability, clearly. But, you know, as you analyze, you have to generalize. You can't avoid it, but you always need to be careful when you're generalizing.
It brings to mind when I was investigated by Columbia for basically the same things that you're mentioning. You know, right. I've had my other details, but right. I had two, and I should mention, non-Jewish lawyers grill me for 8 hours, and in one of the things, they show me one of my own social media right. posts talking about the protests, and they said, this is unacceptable, because did you ask each and every person who's protesting if they believe in this?
Right.
And I said, no. But I also, when I see 100,000 people shouting Heil Hitler, I never asked any 100 of them, 100,000 of them, you know, do you believe that Jews should be exterminated, right. or are you just going with the flow, or are you here for taxes, or are you here?
Right.
Like, it does not matter. It's the protests, it's the leaders that are the problem. And right. if you are setting such a high bar
right.
for speaking out against anti-Semitism, you're basically saying you're not allowed to speak about
it. There was something wrong with asking them if they believe in it? Like, isn't that what you do as like have a conversation, like, and you want to know, like, well, why are you there? What are your reasons? And maybe they're based on false premises, which I believe is like systematically the case. There's a tremendous amount of just lies and misrepresentations and omissions about Israel, right? So, like, you know, if you're here because you think they're committing genocide, and I can convince you they're not committing genocide, wouldn't that change your mind? Like, yeah. It seems to me that's the question the professor should ask. It's the first question you should ask. It's the beginning of the dialogue.
A lot of things were weird and are still weird on campuses. But there is a dark cloud hovering over our conversation, which I think we need to address. The anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people would listening in and say, yeah, of course. But then some people would say, wait, spell that out for me, you know. You keep referring to yourself as a Zionist, as a Zionist. I was a Zionist as a right. student. I'm a Zionist professor. And then you make the jump to, it's because I'm a Jew.
So, you know, I mentioned I wrote a 100-page article on that. I'm happy to. I think it appears in volume 2, actually. I think it may not be quite 100 pages. But so, you know, this is the philosophical analysis. It's certainly possible to be an anti-Zionist without being an anti-Semite. And I don't think you want the long professorial answer here, I'm hoping, because, yeah. But it, of course it's possible. I mean, just the way you define them, anti-Zionism is some form in most people, you know, if it's rejecting the right of the Jews to have sovereignty in their ancestral homeland, that sounds a little bit more problematic, right? But if they say, if your anti-Zionism is just the ability to criticize Israel, well, duh, that's not anti-Semitic. And anti-Semitism is supposedly some form of hostility towards the Jews. And we easily distinguish the Jewish people from any state or government should be subject to criticism, etc. So on paper, not a problem, right? Clearly distinguishable. But, you know, in order to answer that question properly, there's a number of different things that you could do. So what I do partly in this paper is show, first of all, wherever there is anti-Semitism, there is anti-Semitism clearly and logically leads to anti-Zionism. And I can spell that out in some detail. It's part of this bigger project that I hope we'll get to before we finish. And by the way, I'm not paying attention to time, so I assume you'll cut me off. You know, professors, they pay us by the word, as I like to say. So where there's anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism follows logically. And I can spell that out, as I mentioned, you know, which means if you've got a crowd of anti-Zionists, you know, probably some of them are coming from the place of anti-Semitism, right? And wherever there's anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism also follows logically and presumably psychologically, at least in many, maybe not all. There can be exceptions, right? So basically, once you acknowledge, and who doesn't acknowledge this, that Israel is the Jewish state, That doesn't mean all Israelis are Jews or all Jews are Israelis. Those are stupid red herrings, right? It's the Jewish state. Half the world, Jews in the world live there. Of the remaining half, most of them support it in one way or another, identify with it, etc. Whatever Israel does is what it's the Jewish collective project. So if you hate what Zionism does, if you believe Zionism is ethnic cleansing, genocidal, baby killer, racist, apartheid, all that stuff, right? Then you believe the Jews are guilty of those things. And why wouldn't you hate the Jews? So if anti-Semitism, roughly speaking, is hating the Jews, right, then anti-Zionism leads logically. You should be an anti-Semite. And famous Stephen Salada, who was a professor who got one of the rare, I think rare, they'll dispute this, rare professors who got canceled on the other side as an anti-Zionist. Are you familiar with his story? So this was also right around 2015-ish. The details are in dispute a little bit, but he had been hired by the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And then I think his tweets over the 2014 war, so I was not alone getting in trouble, but his tweets were pretty nasty, I would argue, anti-Semitic tweets. And one of his famous tweets was Zionism, making anti-Semitism honorable since 1948 or something like that. And to be fair, he put anti-Semitism in scare quotes, but never, because he's denying he's an anti-Semite. But what he is acknowledging is what everyone knows to be true, which is if you hate Zionism for the reasons just mentioned, you should hate the Jews because the Jews are guilty of all of those things. And right. So anti-Semitism leads logically and psychologically to anti-Zionism. Anti-Zionism leads logically and psychologically to anti-Semitism. You can distinguish them on paper and by definition, but in the minds of many, many of the proponents of each, they're intertwined, right?
I tell people, you know, and there's also the historical reason versus the statistical, there's all different reasons. But I tell people, just don't say anti-Zionist. Say that you are against the right for the Jewish people for self-determination in their ancestral homeland. And if you can say that and scream that and say, I am an anti-Jewish self-determination, then tell me how you feel. Right. Are you really an anti...
Well, I'll play devil's advocate for a moment, which is to say, well, I'm not against that right in principle. I'm thinking of the famous Herzl Chalidi correspondence. I don't know if you're familiar with that, like 1899-ish, right, give or take, right? So Chalidi, who I believe is the, you know, the ancestor of the current, like Rashid Chalidi, just retired from Columbia, good colleague of yours, I'm sure, good friend. you know, so he was a very lovely gentleman. And he writes this famous letter to Herzl saying, and, you know, the Zionist quote the first half of the letter and the anti-Zionist quote the second. So the first half, he says, you know, it would be wonderful to have the Jews reconstituted in their ancestral homeland. And he says famously, you know, by God, historically, it really is your country. And you could make so many contributions to the world if, you know, the great genius of the Jews, if they could come together. So all the, like, Herzlian reasons for Zionism, he rehearses them. But then he goes through the long history. He says, but unfortunately, there's another population here, and they're not going to take kindly to it. And, you know, the only way it's going to happen is with bloodshed. So he closes by saying famously, like, by God, leave Palestine alone or something along those lines. I think it's such an instructive letter. I teach a seminar on Zionism, anti-Zionism, and I love this correspondence. And Herzl writes back very naively, I think. But in any case, I call him a modest or moderate anti-Zionist. He recognizes the Jewish story. He recognizes that on some level, the Jews have some sort of right or it would be just, etc. But at least on a practical level, it's not practical. It will require violence, right? And what he leaves out, my criticism of that letter is, you know, if you really believe in the first half of the letter that historically it is your country and the Jews could do wonderful things here and they should have the right to come back, then the people who are resisting that are unjust, right? If that's a just movement, Jabotinsky says something similar. If you believe in the justice of the movement, which Jabotinsky certainly does, and even this guy certainly lays it down, that the justice of the movement, then the people resisting it are unjust. And do you not pursue justice just because bigots will be violent towards you? And then we talk about, like, the civil rights movement. There were, you know, segregationists who were prepared to be violent to stop desegregation. So should we not have done desegregation? And
you can even take it to today and say, you know, Palestinian self-determination involves violence and bloodshed. So should, you know, Palestinians and their supporters drop that requirement, because, you know,
so it gets complicated very, very quickly. And what's nice about this conversation is you can begin to see kind of multiple sides of it, which is good. I have to come back to answering the question. I haven't quite finished the question yet, but you know, what I try to teach my students is I prefer to refer to the conflict. Nobody follows me in this. I have to write, I've been meaning to write a paper, but I call it the Israeli-Palestinian Jewish-Arab-Muslim-Iran conflict. And even that leaves out major players like, first of all, Christianity and the Cold War, the United States-Soviet Union, right? And if you can walk away understanding how complex this thing is ultimately, that's a win, I think, from pedagogical perspective, et cetera. So we're starting to get into how complex this is. But to come back to the question, we're always playing devil's advocate. I believe in the Jewish right to self-determination, but unfortunately it comes up against other things that are also, you know, justice, et cetera, including the people who were living there. There was no way to exercise that right, et cetera.
I would say for that is you don't get to pick and choose rights. Either all people have the same right or none of them have the same right.
Right.
If you say, I'm going to hold the Jewish people to a different standard in order to decide whether they get the right, then you're already being anti-Semitic. Now, of course, you can. I wholly respect people that are protesting and they are against every ethnic national state.
Right.
I don't respect them if they're only protesting the one Jewish state. But if you're out there saying Israel shouldn't exist, Pakistan shouldn't exist, Myanmar shouldn't exist, you know, you might even say that Norway, Sweden, and Finland, who have the cross in their, in their flag, shouldn't exist. Then I would say I disagree with you, but I respect your conviction.
Yeah, no, and it is so. The way I respond to that, two ways. One of which is very similar to yours. You know, it's to say, well, first of all, I think just in general, from a philosophical perspective, there's many things we consider to be rights and virtues, but in generally they contradict each other in all sorts of ways. So we're always, there's no ideal world where everything virtuous is manifest, right? Because some things exclude other things. So that's an issue we all have to deal with. But, you know, looking back to the Herzl-Khalidi correspondence, the response is, yeah, I don't think that Jews would have the right to come in with an army and commit genocide and, you know, take over by violence. But that's not exactly how the Zionist movement went. They purchased land. They immigrated, right? They more or less followed the laws that were reigning at the time, with some exception. That gets very complicated. But they didn't come in and say, this is ours, we're conquering it. The reason they came here was because of this longstanding historical relationship, blah, 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 and religious reasons and for some, et cetera. And they conquered it not by military conquest, but by more or less following the norms of the time, right? So that's one way to respond. I agree with you. They have, but you know, as long as it could be accomplished while respecting rights and values that were and laws that were in place at the time, there's nothing to object to here, right? And what people don't realize is that today, if you know, when someone says, and this is your double standard point, which I'm coming to too, if someone says to you, too many Mexicans in Texas or in, L.A., they're like turning the place into like Mexico now, et cetera. What does every decent person of the left say? What a racist you are, right? Like that there's something wrong with people, especially if they're immigrating legally, right? Like most of which have immigrated legally. You're a racist for saying, I don't like that the character of this place is changing. I don't like hearing Spanish, right? Well, how are the local Arabs any different if they don't like Jews moving in legally and purchasing land? I could understand from a human psychology perspective, we're all like this. It's a little weird when your neighborhood starts to change its character, right? We're all subject to feeling uncomfortable there. But today we call that racism. And yet no one on the left will look back at the Palestinians in the first part of the 20th century and say they were racists for resisting Jewish immigration, right? But the situations are pretty parallel there, and this is kind of a double standard,
and
right?
I think it's even more parallel because Texas and California used to be Mexico,
right? Yeah, exactly. So, and that is the, in terms of the double standards, you'll find all sorts of hypocrisy. So one I'll just mention, they're a big fan of saying, by any means necessary, you can resist colonization, the right to, resist occupation by any means necessary. So, I like to point out that, so if you think you're justified basically in mass slaughter of Israelis / Jews, because we know that's the ultimate target, mass slaughter of Israelis in order to exercise your self-determination, then why weren't the Jews justified in doing the same thing in getting their self-determination? Like you criticize Zionism allegedly for genocidal ethnic cleansing, but somehow it's just in your case, right? So you'll find that all the time. this kind of hypocrisy, double standards.
You, I do want to mention from your book, from Israel Breve's World Condemns, from the first volume, there's a part where it really spells it out beautifully.
Thank you.
I want to read it out. When Israel is held to standards that no other country is held to, something is wrong. When Israel is singled out for rebuke while other nations do far worse things, then something is wrong. When Israel's actions engage the attention and emotions of the world while worse actions elsewhere are overlooked, then something is wrong. And when, in discussing Israel, one ignores all the counter evidence to one's claims, one ignores or falsely denies important facts, one leaves out all the relevant context, and one proceeds as if Arab hostile actions have absolutely no role to play in Israel's behavior, then something is wrong too.
I agree completely.
I'm Andrew Pastin, and I
approve this message. Yeah,
I think it really boils down the point
right.
is you're allowed to criticize Israel as you're allowed to criticize every
other country, but when you only criticize Israel, right? You know, and that's one more aspect of anti-Zionism being anti-Semitic. I sometimes do this analogy: imagine there were, you know, 10 men, 9 white men, 1 black man, and all of them were doing horrible things, you know, criminals or whatever, doing unjust. Vicious in the moral sense, illegal things, and you spent all your time just focusing on the black man's crimes, right? Mm-hmm. No one would hesitate. And what you're saying is true. He's committing those crimes, and you're right to, you know, judge him and reproach him and publicize them. But no one would doubt for a second that you're a racist if you focus all your energy on all the alleged crimes of the black man and ignore the 9 other white men. It's exactly comparable. Even if what they said of Israel were true, which we know it isn't, that's a separate issue. But even if it were true, the single-minded focus on the one Jewish state in the world, imagine Israel is the one black state in the world and all the rest of the countries are white, which is, you know, more or less, well, not exactly true, but close enough, right? You know, it would be so obvious that all these people care about is what the black state does and all the evil things. So even if it was true, that single-minded focus is a sign of the racism in the person.
Right. So before we end, I want to ask you, what is the protocols of the elders of
Protocols of the Elders of Anti-Zion. Isn't that a catchy title?
It's
wouldn't you pick up an essay? I have an essay with that title. Wouldn't you pick up a book with that title?
I'm waiting for it to come out.
All right, so I'm working on it. Okay. So this is my my major new project. I'm about to launch it. It's sort of underway behind the scenes a little bit now. It's in its earliest stages, but it's become clear to me that, first of all, we've largely lost the campus battle, both, you know, the rhetoric battle. Campuses, again, the major campuses are toxic to Jews. Jews are toxic to them. Zionism is toxic to them. So we need to do something to reclaim the universities. In a longer discussion, we could talk about whether Trump's moves are good or bad, or, you know, things like that. I do believe most universities will need some outside pressure. I don't think they can correct themselves from within. I've become convinced that what we really need to focus on, first of all, is not anti-Semitism anymore, not that it's gone away, but we've lost that battle. They, despite what we were just saying, what's so obvious to us and people on our side, the haters have effectively convinced people that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism, and our long efforts over the last number of years to convince people that it is, whatever, it's failed, even though we know it's true, right? And it's time to move on to some other strategy. So I think it is time to actually study anti-Zionism in its own right. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that I won't go into unless you have follow-up questions. So I want to turn the focus to anti-Zionism as an unacceptable form of bigotry in its own right, whether or not you decide it's equivalent to anti-Semitism. Even if it isn't, it's still a problem. And, you know, the most superficial explanation of that is, you know, national origin discrimination. So I don't hate Jews, I just hate Israelis. Well, actually, that's not acceptable either, right? You know, it becomes a form of bigotry. What's interesting about anti-Zionism is it has a very, very interesting history. And so with all the attention rightly paid to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the famous anti-Semitic forgery, which spells out this alleged Jewish conspiracy to conquer the world and subjugate or eliminate the Gentiles, basically. That document is literally at the heart of all the major anti-Zionism of the 20th century. With all the attention paid to that conspiracy theory, which is a derogatory term, right? When you call something conspiracy theory, you say like they're nut jobs or something like that. What's been overlooked is that there's an actual conspiracy, but in the opposite direction. There literally is an organized, systematic, globalized campaign to ultimately to destroy the Jews, right? And anti-Zionism is the product of that campaign. I truly believe, and we could argue about the word conspiracy there, but I think it fits. We need to see anti-Zionism as an actual, organized, systematic campaign, global campaign, to destroy the Jews. And once you see that, right, there's the anti-Semitism. If what anti-Zionism is at heart, it isn't criticism of this or that Israeli policy. It is part of a conspiracy to destroy the Jews. And first of all, the question, is it anti-Semitism, couldn't be more obvious. Like, any movement to destroy the Jews is pretty clearly anti-Semitic. So I've written a very long essay sort of looking at the major players in that conspiracy. And every little piece of this is known, but what has not been done yet, as far as I can see, is draw all the pieces together under one roof and see them as a conspiracy. So the pieces, it begins with protocols of the Elders of Zion, so pre-Soviet Russia, hotbed of anti-Semitism, right, that produces this unbelievable work, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That, of course, is a major influence of the Nazis. Hitler had it on his bedside table. According to Goebbels, Hitler had memorized it, and not only that, according to Hannah Arendt, not only did this give the Nazis the excuse to go after the Jews, and they, of course, portrayed it as resistance, defense, right? The Jews are trying to destroy us, so we have to defend ourselves against the Jews. Today they call it resistance, but it's the same inversion, right? So not only did it give the Nazis the motivation to use, according to Hannah Arendt, it gave Hitler the idea of, like, you know what, conquering the globe and destroying, you know, inferior peoples, that's a great idea. It gave literally him the idea to undertake the Nazi campaign. The next major player, and the Nazis, by the way, disseminated this book into the Arab Muslim world, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, but of course, Soviet Union, that's a well-documented story, organized systematic anti-Zionism, and most importantly, both the Nazis, and tell me when I'm going on too much detail, but the Nazis and the Soviets, both, who were the main leaders of this? It was the professors, right? They created, there were all these institutes, and in Russia it was Zionologists, like there were institutes for Zionology, and their goal was to produce basically anti-Zionist literature because they wanted to destroy the Jews.
And so, today they're called the Critical Study of
the Zionism. Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism, which is today's version of that. And when you look at what they do in their organization, it's the spinning image, as I say, not there's a wonderful book called Hitler's Professors, but then there's Brezhnev's Professors in the Soviet Union, and now there's Hamas's Professors, which is this institute. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it's Western progressivism, which comes right out of the Soviet Union, right, etc. So when you begin to realize this, these are just the major players, and there's all sorts of other players in this conspiracy. When I looked at, in particular, the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism, which is what you just said, I call them now Hamas's professors, I realized, well, obviously there needs to be an Institute for the Critical Study of Anti-Zionism, which will expose this conspiracy theory, conspiracy, not a conspiracy, it's an actual conspiracy, right? That's the crucial thing. And not to mention combat this other institute, which is already disseminating the same types of propaganda that Hitler's professors and Brezhnev's professors produced, using many of the same tropes. It's just these, you know, genocidal ethnic cleansing baby killers goes back to the early part of the 20th century. There's nothing new here. We need to clearly push back. They're also, they've already got a podcast and a journal, and they're preparing curricula for K-12, right, which is, you know, the next major battlefront for this ideology. So I am launching the Institute and announcing it here. I don't know when this will drop, but the Institute for the Critical Study of Anti-Zionism, there's some concrete moves underway. I'm claiming that title right here. So I've already gotten all the URLs, so I've got that. But I'm launching that. I know a bunch of professors I'm quite sure will be interested in collaborating. I'm seeking supporters and collaborators. So if you think anti-Zionism needs to be fought on campus, please reach out to me, because I want to be the point person for that. And I'm starting this institute to fight anti-Zionism.
So I'm going to have you back once that institute is up and running.
Happy to
see what you've learned. So we're going to end with the Here I Am lightning round, a series of rapid fire questions. You're a professor. I know you did your homework. Andrew Pessin, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Many years ago in a previous life, I made some films with David Letterman that aired on the David Letterman show. They were superheroes, the strong guy, the fat guy, and the genius, and I was the genius. So I get to say I'm not a real genius. I just played one on TV.
And by the way, I've watched one of those.
Well, you've done your homework, clearly, by the way.
Very fun. And it's also like David Letterman is so young there. So,
and as was I, as I said, previous life.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
I don't think that question was included in the list that you kindly sent to me. So, but you did ask other people that. They don't know just how great we are, that we are, as a people, we have our exceptions, of course, but we are kind and generous, and we want nothing more than two things, which is to be left alone and be Jews, and then to contribute to the world and make it a better place.
What is your favorite curse?
May you live in interesting times, which, of course, is often represented as a Chinese blessing. But in my view, especially over the last 2 years, it's been enough interesting. It's too interesting. So
I want to be bored.
I want to be bored. I miss just being an American philosopher.
When was the last time you cried?
This morning. I will again this evening, when you lie down and when you get up, and at least once during the day. I like to think I tend to be a pessimistic person. My philosophy is a mix of Samuel Beckett and René Descartes, who I used to study, which is I weep, therefore I am, weeping is such an interesting thing. We weep at happy things and we weep at terrible things. I don't know, do we have any other emotions that we apply to completely opposite things? So I feel like something is interesting there. Laughter. Do we laugh at out of discomfort
and discomfort?
Nervous
and
laughter.
Out of happiness and joy.
And I have to think more about that philosophically. Yeah. Like that. But weeping's is good.
I weep before I am. If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
It'd be you, clearly. My wife listened to your episode, I haven't yet, with your wife. She's a big fan of your wife now. So if
we'll
any.
Come over.
Yeah, okay. We're free Friday, so.
Well, it has to be on Friday.
This Friday.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
That's sort of like asking who's your favorite child. You know, they all are. Each one has their strengths and their challenges. And at least publicly, you have to say you like them all equally.
So, I mean, that's going to make it very difficult for the next question, which is, what is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
None of them.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, or all of them, right? All of them, because, you know, my wife and I have had a running joke over the years. You're not allowed to say it in public, but we had a little chart ranking our three kids, and there would be motion. Sometimes one was number one 1 week, but when we would make that joke in public, people would look at us like we were horrible ogres. So publicly, the view is we love all our children equally at all times.
On average.
On average, yes.
When do you feel safest?
Never, but, you know, Jewish condition, isn't that...
So
it could all end in a moment. That's the Jewish condition in the diaspora. Like, no matter how you keep the suitcase packed. I mentioned I'm a pessimist. As I like to say, my glass is 2/3 empty and leaking. So never in the diaspora and, the homeland in some respect, but the homeland, especially these days, you got the missiles and the terrorists. It's scary everywhere. Yeah. So I don't get invited to a lot of Shabbos dinners, so maybe you can rethink that invitation.
When do you feel least safe? Is there
never.
A moment where you
Wait,
feel
never like, always.
Is there a moment where you feel like, oh, this is...
No, I am always on edge, especially the last couple of years. I took shooting lessons about a year ago, figuring it, better before the pogrom than after the pogrom. That seemed to make sense. And I haven't followed up on it because it's not me. I don't want to be doing this. It was actually a lot of fun, but... I really didn't want a gun in our house, and I didn't want to believe that I need one. But I think intellectually, I think Jews should be armed at this point. I really believe that, unfortunately. Yeah.
This is going to be probably the hardest question for Andrew Pessimist. What gives you hope?
I actually have a good answer, a real answer to that one. I mean, those were real answers, but the young people, and if the young people don't give you hope, then you're really screwed, right? Mm-hmm. First and foremost, the young men and women of the IDF, the lions and lionesses of Zion, I mean, they are such superheroes, not just for their answering the call and their bravery and their success, but having to live up against the world's slanders and defamation, like these are people are monsters or something like that, when they are, and I see these college students in comfort in the West, on campuses, condemning them as like genocidal maniacs or something like that. And like these people are worthless compared to the young men and women of the IDF. These are superhero human beings who at the age of 18, 19, 20, are going through horrors and dying and getting maimed to defend their country from genocidal maniacs, and you criticize them. Like, it's just, it's stunning. So, and then there's some American Jews. I really, a good number of them rose to the challenge. I'm sure you're familiar with, you know, many of them. And these give me hope for the future. And it is time for the Jewish leadership to exit and be replaced by this young generation. So I'm looking forward to that.
I would say both in Israel and in the diaspora,
yeah.
New leadership. Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want listeners to donate to this?
Can I mention two or three?
You can mention how
yeah, so many. I think it's called Leket Yisrael, Leket. Which is feeding people. And yeah. You know,
L-E-K-E-T.
L-E-K-E-T, yeah. It's feeding people. And it was, you know, especially seeing a lot of it in the first months after October 7th. You know, people dismiss Israeli suffering because in the current paradigm, Israel is the oppressor, and they don't realize how many Israelis are suffering. And was it hundreds of thousands were displaced, and still many are still displaced, and farms were not functional, etc. Like, there were people who needed food in Israel, and, you know, Israel helps everybody, but very few people come to help Israel. So Leket Yisrael was doing some wonderful work there. I just went to an event with an Israeli soldier just out of the army, and he's running a campaign to provide basically rehabilitation services to IDF veterans, both physical and the mental, like the post-traumatic stress disorder, and not to mention, you know, prosthetic limbs and things like that. And just, you know, the debt we owe to the IDF is just...
What's the organization?
I can't remember the name, but I'm sorry.
Brothers for Life?
Well, he's apparently starting a new one, which, so, you know, there's always that issue of competing in that space. But you know, any one of them that is legitimate, like, we owe it to the veterans of the IDF. I mean, I think Western civilization owes it to the veterans of the IDF. We didn't quite talk about that. And then lastly, I'm a big fan of the Tikva Fund people, tikvafund.org, who saw more than 10 years ago that part of the diaspora problem is the thinning and dilution of Jewish identity. And they're all about Jewish education, and they've been doing it for 10 or 12 years, and they're now starting some new university programs. They've been developing programs. They have a high school now, and they've been doing, for a while, they're doing a bunch of online stuff for middle schoolers and high schoolers. If we're going to fight back in the diaspora, we have to be Jews. And too many American Jews are not Jews, or not, you know, skin deep at best. And they've been really groundbreaking work in Jewish education and they've decided that the universities can't be reformed, so it's time to create alternative programs. And I respect that. I think we should still fight to reclaim our universities, but we should, you know, we have to battle on every front. So they're starting new institutions. It's wonderful. Support them.
That's great. Andrew, where can people find you? Where can they find your weekly updates?
I do have a website, andrewpessin.com, so you can find out more about me and my work. And I do think I have one Letterman clip linked on my website. Please don't laugh at how I looked then, unless you also laugh at how I look now, that would be fair. So that would be the main thing. I do have a Substack, which is called Pariah, But the Truth You Know Ain't a Democracy, which is how I do feel most of the time, at least in the academic environment. I do put a lot of my writings there. My essay, Protocols of the Elders of Anti-Zion, can be found there. And I've also been doing, as I mentioned, this weekly 10-minute podcast, like a news program, giving the highlights and lowlights of campus anti-Zionism, called The Week That Was, But We Mostly Wish It Wasn't.
The Week That Was, But We Mostly Wish It Wasn't.
Yeah, sorry, I'm a pessimist, as you said.
I would say that about the last 2 years of war. I wish for weren't. Well, it's been a delight. Again, Israel Breathes, The World Condemns is 2 volumes about all your writing about anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism of the last 10 years.
Documenting the trajectory and then documenting the aftermath on campuses. So,
and I just want to thank you for coming and say, here I am with Professor Andrew Pessin.
Here I am with you. Thank you so much. It was a privilege and an honor.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality. and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."